And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Criminal justice has certainly been an issue for the nation, also here in Iowa, especially in recent years. A study released in 2013 by the ACLU showed that blacks in Iowa were about 8 times more likely than whites to be arrested for the possession of a small amount of marijuana. This is even though both groups, both blacks and whites, use pot at about the same rate. That disparity was the worst in the nation, according to the ACLU study. In his State of the Judiciary address in the start of 2016, Chief Justice Mark Cady of the Iowa Supreme Court called for Iowa to lead the way in reducing these disparities. He noted that 9.4%, nearly 10%, nearly 1 in 10 of Iowa's adult black men are incarcerated. That's the third highest percentage in the nation. This hour, we want to get a unique perspective on criminal justice reform from a convicted felon, also a former gang member who's speaking in Iowa. Jason Soll is with us, an adjunct faculty member in criminal justice at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's also the author of From Prison to PhD, a memoir of hope, resilience, and second chances. Jason will be speaking Friday, November 4th at 5 p.m. in Iowa City at the Public Library as part of Iowa City's Witching Hour Festival. Jason Soll, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your youth growing up. Later you moved to Waterloo, but tell us how this started in Chicago, how you became a gang member.
When you grow up in poverty-stricken areas, you know, and it's not to make a justification, I definitely take full responsibility of joining and everything that came with it, but it was so easy, you know, to join a gang because there was no outlets for, you know, cash. There were no outlets to play. The gangs kind of ran everything in the city, and it's been a gangster city since the days of Al Capone and even before that. So, and you look at Chicago, you think about when the war on drugs hit. I was born in 78. You know, the war on drugs was initiated in 82. So I watched my father struggle with addiction. I watched relatives struggle with addiction. And when I reached the, you know, adolescence, it just made sense to join a gang to make money. You know, I was just tired of being broke, and I got weak, and I just said, you know what, I'm going to make this decision. I didn't think I would be the one to go to prison or get shot up or any of those things, but it actually comes with the territory. So before I made it to Waterloo, Iowa, I had been highly involved in the gang in Chicago, and it led to a lot of, you know, a lot more trauma in my life.
How old were you when you first became a, I guess, full-fledged gang member, when it was part of your daily life?
14.
What was a typical day like? Give us a sense for those of us who've never been in a gang.
Yeah.
What do you do during the day? What did you do in the height of your gang activity?
Well, in the height, you know, that was really the summer because I was a good student throughout. You know, and that's what people don't understand. I've always been in gifted and talented classes, so I, you know, have a sharp mind. So for me, it looked like I played basketball all 4 years of high school. So I had practice, and I played for a really competitive team in Chicago. I played for Dunbar High School. So we would have things in the summer pro-am, different things like that. But the selling of the drugs is what kept me in the streets most, you know, because for me, I just want to be in places where it's like I'm around people, I'm having fun, I'm laughing and joking. Anybody who knows me know that's been my personality. But for me, late-night drug sales was a part of what I did. You know, smoking marijuana throughout the day was something that happened. People were shot in my neighborhood. I don't know what it takes to shoot somebody, but I didn't have whatever that was. I don't know if it's anger or pain or, you know, I don't know what it is, but I didn't have that, but I was always around it. So for me, a typical day was playing basketball, selling drugs, smoking weed, and whatever else came with neighborhood activities like that. But It was always ambiguous. You never knew what was going to happen. But you think about the summer of 94, you know, I was 16, turned 16 that summer. It was very murderous summer in Chicago, and I was out there. I had to make decisions. I had to be a part of, you know, some key critical decisions, and I'm just grateful that I didn't take one of those fatal bullets.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a lot of your friends, fellow gang members, who did take bullets and die?
Absolutely. I lost a lot of great friends. I lost a lot of good people. And whether I was, you know, in the neighborhood at the time or I left the neighborhood and heard about it, it always hurt. And when I was incarcerated, I lost 3 good friends. So I've lost a lot of people due to the gang violence, but we often talk about what happens with gangs, but we often leave out what creates gangs. You know, it's like most people who join gangs are dealing with fatherlessness. Oftentimes it's a poor community. You can go to any city, you know, in the United States, and you can see some level or some segment that's not doing well. You can always find some element of gangs in those areas, whether they call it or classify it as a gang. You can see somebody trying to survive in a underworld. And, you know, unfortunately, I hate that I fell victim to that, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Jason Soll is my guest. Now he's a faculty member in criminal justice at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, author of From Prison to PhD, a memoir of hope, resilience, and second chances. So we're talking about how he became a convicted felon after becoming a gang member and where he is today. We'll get to that in just a moment. But so when we talk about your gang activity, you at a certain point you were brought to Waterloo. Your mother sent you to live with relatives in Waterloo. Why?
Well, I played in the Boys in the Hood camp, the top basketball players in Chicago. The Chicago Bulls come out there, and like it's an honor to be invited to the camp. And while I was at the camp, my mom was looking through some of my things, and it's my fault. You know, I hate that I got a lot of regret with my story, but I rushed out the house, left residue on a glass mirror, trying to have some money to go out there, which was an hour outside of Chicago. And while I was at the camp, I mean, it was the best time, man. It was the best time of my life, man. I played, and the bullshit, Charles Oakley was saying that I can be one of the best players in the city of Chicago. And it was like I left that camp feeling like I'd be one of the top in the city, you know, my junior year. So I left with a lot of energy. But when I came back, my mom had everything laid out, the scales, the baggies, and it just broke her heart, you know. And she really didn't know what to do because she raised me right. You know, I got a strong mom, love my mom dearly, but it broke her heart. And she just thought the best thing to do was to take me outside of the city. And, I mean, in retrospect, it might have been the best decision, but oftentimes people don't know what that transition is like. I went from 16 years of growing up in Chicago. Now I'm in Iowa where it's like I really don't know how things go. I never had interactions with people other than African Americans. I went to school with blacks from kindergarten all the way through my sophomore year. Never went to school with anybody other than African Americans. So now I'm trying to assimilate in a totally new environment, culture, city, etc. And when I went to Iowa, I did pretty good. You know, I left there, with a good plan, with motivation. I left there inspired to do well, but I ran into some more troubles.
Mm-hmm. So how did that change you going to Waterloo? Did you get involved with some of the same elements to the degree that they existed in Waterloo that you were involved with in Chicago?
It was nowhere near the same, but just having a reputation, going down there, knowing that I got caught with drugs, knowing I had a gang tattoo placed on my arm, and, you don't usually see that, especially back then. And so I came with baggage already. So when I first entered the school, they knew I was a Chicago kid who had gang involvement, got caught selling drugs. So it looked bad walking through the door. But I excelled. You know, I played for Waterloo East. You know, we went downstate, competed for a championship. I ran in Drake relays. I had enough credits to graduate, in January rather than going the full year. So it was like I always took care of my studies, but my home life was tough because I lived with my aunt, who had never raised kids, and it was just a tumultuous environment. But, going to Waterloo, I had fights. I got in trouble. It was like, and that's what made my aunt ultimately kick me out. She was worried that people would come to my house or to her house and actually harm me and possibly her. So she just made the decision, to kick me out. So I had to, pretty much fend for myself my senior year. But I had friends. I had people who cared about me. I stayed different parts. It wasn't like I was homeless. But I definitely didn't have a place to call home.
Mm-hmm. You ended up in prison. How did that happen?
When I walked across the stage to complete, my high school, what was it? I don't know, Sullivan Brothers Center. When I walked across, it was already documented that I was going to the Air Force. So February of my senior year, I was signed, sealed, and delivered to go, enlisted in the Air Force. But they called me while I was in Chicago because I went back to Chicago after I graduated. The very next day after I graduated, I went back to Chicago, and they called me maybe, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before my boot camp date, and they said, hey, we got to run some tests on you because you had asthma as a kid. So they ran these tests on me, even though I passed the physical before. It's a three-part physical to go to the military. I passed all of that. I ran in direct relay. I had, you know, shown that, you know, asthma wasn't a problem for me. And, you know, they ran these tests, and they said, you can't go now. And it just upset me, so I went right back to the streets. In that frustration.
In the streets in Chicago.
Yeah, in the streets of Chicago. So I ran back to what I knew best. I'm back selling drugs. You know, I had a job at Target, but, you know, I felt like a loser because I had some levels of success. And it, like, you know, playing at a high level in basketball, then running in Drake and doing all those phenomena. I won awards, was invited to the Botillion Ball. It was like I had some levels of success. So to be living in my mom's basement just really frustrated me. And my buddy from Minnesota said, hey, why don't you come down here? And I was like, okay, came to Minnesota. I got caught with a gun. What was that, 3 months after coming?
Caught with a gun.
Yeah, got caught with a firearm.
And that's that's what sent you to prison? How long were you in prison?
That sent me to do workhouse time. So I did 60 days in jail and 5 years of probation. So the very next year I got shot up. You know, I got a rod and screws on my leg. You know, I got shot with a .40 caliber. Year after that, I got caught with drugs. That's what sent me to prison. So I went in at 21, and I finished the incarceration phase 8 days after my 24th birthday. So went into prison for a while and really didn't use that time wisely. I was a leader while I was in there. I was an activist. I fought things while I was in there, but really wasn't ready for release. Because prison just doesn't prepare you for relief.
Mm-hmm. Jason Soll is my guest, if you've just joined us. He's now an adjunct faculty member in criminal justice at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, author of From Prison to PhD, A Memoir of Hope, Resilience, and Second Chances. And, Jason, we have about almost 10 minutes left. I want to get to the part we've talked about. It's kind of the descending into what you had, the gang violence, the prison. So let's bring it out. So let's talk about when things started to change for you, I guess, in your mindset. Did that change all at once?
Well, my mindset never changed. I always knew that I wanted to do well. Even when I was selling drugs at 15, 16 years old, I always said I was going to do something differently. I used to tell my friends, I mean, even when I had $50,000, $60,000, I would say, I'm not doing this forever. Like, I'm definitely getting out of this at some point. So it was always there. My friends know I always talked about it. Even after I got caught with the gun, I slowed things down a little bit. But when I got shot, everything escalated. So now I'm back, you know, carrying the firearms, looking for people, violent fights, et cetera. And, you know, when I got out of prison, I said, I'm going to try some things differently. I'm going to try and move out of the hood, even though that was the only place I can get housing. I said, I got to figure out a way out of the hood. When I started trying to live in different environments, I wasn't wanted or welcome. So I said, let me try college. Going to college gave me a different identity. So I became a student leader. I started studying criminal justice so I can learn my laws. I started meeting new friends who knew nothing about prison, who knew nothing about gangs. And it was like being around people who had no idea of what that life was like changed me a lot. And I took a major fall even while I was a college student at 26, one of my best friends set me up with drugs, and this is when I was doing good. I mean, I was on billboards. I was mentoring kids. I actually had a job at the halfway house I was released to. I had got off parole. Like, I was doing pretty good, and it all came crashing down. I mean, I won awards. I was leading rallies. I was doing a lot of stuff, and then I took a major fall, but I fought through it. I graduated, got my four-year degree in 3 years. Took some tough classes, took on some tough tasks, and I started seeing that I could do a whole lot more with my life. So when I took that major fall, I was facing 110 months in prison, but the community came out. Over 300 people came to my court date and fought on my behalf, and I received a downward departure. And that's when I said, you know what, this is, you know, like, I got to cut the streets off completely. Like, nobody, you know, in that world can be around me. And it hurt to do that because, you know, some of them were my good friends. I loved them, didn't want to make them think I was better than them. But I knew I had to, you know, strive for a little bit better. And now, you know, I'm working. I've been teaching criminal justice 7 years. I'm a national speaker, national trainer. I'm a great father, a wonderful husband. And I got a pretty good life. And, you know, just a couple of days ago, I was elected as the president of the Minneapolis NAACP. So I'm sitting in positions now well, I'm actually instilling hope in a lot of people, and it just feels good to be able to turn things around.
Well, it feels good, Jason, to hear your story turn out the way it has been turning out. We hope you keep on the current course. I want to ask you, though, your unique perspective. You said when you got into education, started studying criminal justice, there were no other people like you. There are no other people like you, or very few. So what do you bring to the table? Because our country, our state, Iowa, where you've lived, is facing criminal justice reform, thoughts about it. What do you bring to this discussion that is valuable for us to hear?
I bring innovative solutions, but first off, I bring truth. You know, we got to be honest about what those numbers represent. You know, the system, you know, it's a system. And when you don't have the proper people in place, people with good hearts who value everyone, you see those disparities. So for me, I bring honesty about the criminal justice system. It's another system that's used to subjugate, to keep certain people at the bottom. Because when you think about crime and justice, it's like there is no justice in the criminal. You think about a sexual assault victim. You think about someone who had their home broken in. Yeah, someone goes to prison, but that doesn't mean I'm going to be okay afterwards. So I can bring a ton of case studies. I can bring a ton of experience. I could talk about what happens when you're in solitary confinement because I've been there. But I also can look at the research and tell you what happens there. You know, people look at me for my speaking engagements, my book, you know, the work that I do. But if you look at the research I've done, I'm like really doing some creative research as well. So for me, I bring not only a personal story, I bring the education to it and also bring creative solutions. And I have a national perspective. I was in Texas last week, in Chicago the week before, and I'll be in Cali next week. So I'm all around where I can look and see what people are doing all over. And I can let Iowa, you know, see the benefits of me being there by actually looking at things from a global perspective.
I mentioned a couple of statistics from here in Iowa right at the outset that I'm sure you heard, Jason. So specifically to Iowa, someone who's a former gang member, served time in prison, who has lived in Iowa. What concerns at the top of the list do you have specifically about Iowa in terms of criminal justice, the way we deal with it, and what reforms would you suggest?
Well, I have limited, I have limited knowledge of what's happening in Iowa. I'm hearing things, but at the end of the day, I see poor people going through the system through assembly line justice. Nope, like public defenders don't have enough time to really represent them. And it's like what Brian Stevenson said, who wrote Just Mercy. You see wealthy people who are guilty get justice more than you see poor people who are innocent. So it's like I see it as a poverty issue. I see it as a mental health issue. I see a school-to-prison pipeline. All the things I'm seeing across the country, I'm pretty sure if I took a, you know, close examination of Iowa, it would be present there as well. So a lot of this revolves around race, lack of resources, mental health, chemical dependency, and things like that. Some people who get caught with drugs go to treatment. Other people go to prison. And unfortunately, a lot of those people look like me.
Mm-hmm. Where do you view, how do you view the politics of criminal justice in our country at this time?
I think we're headed in the right direction. I mean, we're having the conversations. I mean, people are talking all over. You know, I protest, I write, I do a lot of things. And now people are actually saying, yeah, we need to take a closer look at this system because it's not fair. So the conversations are happening, but I'm still not seeing justice take its course. So
are you seeing that from both major parties, or do you contact both major parties? Do you see it as a bipartisan issue now?
What are you referring to?
Well, just that criminal justice needs to be reformed and that it's not such a partisan issue that, like so many issues, we can't move forward on.
Yeah, I think we can move. I see vested interests all around, but you got to understand it's been people who've been operating without accountability. You think about law enforcement, you think about judges, you think about corrections. They've been able to run with very little accountability, if any. So now that we're trying to hold the system accountable, it's creating discomfort and it's creating frustration. And sometimes the people who, even though they see that they need to do something differently, they don't know how because they've been running it so wrong for so long. Now they're in a vulnerable position like, oh, I got to change. I got to think differently. I got to act differently. I got to de-escalate now. And it's throwing them off a little bit. So, yeah, while that might be vested interest, there are some people who are going to still brutalize and oppress. And if we don't fire the people who are not living up to the badge or to the profession, then it's time to, you know, get them out of there. And I'm not seeing that enough.
Jason Soule, before we go, I'm interested, how much contact do you have with former gang members, or do you?
Yeah, I see him. I mean, I'm around. You know, I'm not, you know, someone who's isolated. I'm very public, you know. So, I mean, I always say, you know, if you want to meet for lunch, I'll meet you. But I'm not spending time with anybody who's living that life. But, you know, because I've risen to where I am, I've actually encouraged a lot of them to do things differently. They might not be professors or, you know, give lectures, but they're doing well. They're staying out of trouble. You know, they're working. They're taking care of their families now. So I've inspired a lot of people from my past to actually change. So I still see them. I still say hello, but the conversation is how you doing, how your kids doing. You know, you need anything, you know, you can rely on me. You don't got to be in the streets. You know, it's a different path we can take now. So I see everybody. You know, I see people from the bad, the good. I even see former enemies.
Well, we have to go, but you have gone from a life in a gang on the streets, in a gang, in prison, now to academia. I can't imagine more different worlds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, was it a tough job to adapt to the new world you're in, academia?
Man, it actually came pretty natural. I mean, I got a lot of criticism. I mean, people wrote articles saying, how could you let a criminal become a criminal justice professor? I got a lot of stuff, but I've proven myself. I went through all of that negative attention, and I kept showing that I deserve to be in higher education. I even gave back an assistant professor position at another university because I'm that confident in what I can do. So for me, the professionalism was kind of difficult to go from selling drugs and having a certain amount of money to being patient and doing things the right way and paying bills on time. That was a little different, but I adjusted to, you know, a lot of the things, and I adjusted to, you know, really
okay.
People who didn't want me to stand next to them as professors, but I'm here now.
Okay.
Deal with me.
Jason Saul, we wish you the best of luck. Adjunct faculty member in criminal justice at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, speaking on Friday in Iowa City. Thanks, Jason.
No problem.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Mm-hmm.